All right. I know it's been a long day for everybody in the pre-conference, so I'm really happy that you all came to this panel, because I'm really excited about our panelists and what we're going to have for you that hopefully will have impact on some of the work you're doing. Can everybody hear me? Am I mic'd? Oh, we have some late stragglers. Welcome. So when I was asked to do a panel on sex abuse, I kind of sighed a little bit. For me, I know I've been covering this issue for 20 years. And as journalists, we want to know what's new. We want to break fresh ground. We want to uncover stories that no one has found before. But stories about the sexual abuse of children in religious settings now feel all too familiar. I don't know if that's a common feeling, but that's certainly been my experience. I know that it might sound crude and unfeeling, but these stories may not even feel much like news anymore. It's now 11 years since the Boston Globe uncovered a systemic cover-up of abuse by priests in the Archdiocese of Boston. And the truth is that when those stories were published, the problem of abusive Catholic priests had already been a story for 15 years. But we had no idea of the scope of the problem, how many thousands of children had been molested, and to what extent church leaders had gone to keep it quiet. The scandal that the Globe kicked off taught us things we never knew about the Catholic Church, about how abusers operate, and about the survivors. We learned that it often takes victims years to come to grips with what happened to them, and that the effects of the betrayal are so deep, so insidious, that it can last a lifetime. That reporting was a public service, and it led to greater awareness in society of child sexual abuse. And that awareness has led more and more survivors to get the courage to speak out. So now we're in a new phase, I think. We suddenly have an explosion of sexual abuse scandals in the Boy Scouts, at Penn State University, in competitive swimming, in private prep schools, and even, because it turns out nothing is sacred, on Sesame Street. Have you guys heard about that one? Mm-hmm. Yes. From these scandals, we know that religion is hardly a required ingredient. But there is something about children being abused in a religious setting by God's representatives that makes it particularly traumatic and damaging. It's also what continues to make it a vital and, if I may say, interesting story that religion reporters have a particular responsibility to tell. Here's why. Every faith has pedophiles and perpetrators, but how they operate, how they gain access to their victims, and how the faith's leaders allow them to get away with it is different in each religious culture. If you don't believe me, look at the revelations in a gripping piece that ran last year in Details magazine. I don't know if anybody saw it. It was kind of a sleeper, about Tibetan Buddhist monks preying on their teenage students in monasteries. Look at the groundbreaking stories of abuse by outwardly happily married rabbis, teachers, and fathers in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in New York, and the corollary stories of the threats and intimidation of the members of the Jewish community who dared to report it. And these stories were really, the path was broken by the Jewish press in New York, and New York Times really followed in their wake, but they were really shocking stories. And recently we had some very good and revelatory reporting on abuse by Christian missionaries overseas by our own Manya Brashear, who is here. She did a terrific piece in the Chicago Tribune. So this is why we're so lucky to have these panelists here with us today. They have all, through hard personal experience, become masterful at explaining how and why child abuse happens in the faith they grew up in. But they're not just experts, they're advocates, doing important and heroic work, and also at great personal cost. And hopefully they will help plant some seeds for stories that none of us have yet read or written. So each of them are going to make a short presentation, and then we'll have some questions. So first, we're going to hear from Boz Chavijian. He was a prosecutor for 8 years in Florida and worked on hundreds of cases of child sexual abuse. He took that experience and then spent the last 17 years training prosecutors, investigators, and social workers to handle cases of child sexual abuse. He also founded and is the executive director of GRACE, which stands for Godly Response to Abuse in the Christian Environment. In particular, he tries to help the faith community, but in particular the evangelical Christian community, Protestant community, respond to and prevent sexual abuse. And he has a lot of street cred with this community, I think, because he happens to be the third eldest grandson of the Reverend Billy Graham. He teaches a course on child sexual abuse and the law at Liberty University School of Law and has written a book coming out in October on the issue. So we're happy to have him here. He's going to start us off.
Let me bring my watch. It's probably a thing for all of us.
Okay.
Actually, you're the watch. You're just tugging on my foot. Okay.
Well, I'm honored to be here. I don't think I'm a lawyer by trade, and so I don't think I've ever spoken to a room of journalists, and quite frankly, I'm a little bit nervous. But, you know, most of the lawyer jokes are funny because they're true. So I don't mind if I learn another one while we're here. I really want to spend the next few minutes speaking with you about this issue, primarily with a focus of the Protestant evangelical world. And then, you know, here's my outline for the very next few minutes. It's aggressive, but I think we can do it. I want to give you an equation. The equation is going to be this. A motley group of many, plus independence, plus distorted biblical teaching, equals a climate for abuse and silence. It's about the best equation I can give you that describes much of what we encounter with our organization within the Protestant world. So let me get started. The Protestant world is a motley group of many, as many of you know. It includes over 217 denominations and over 314,000 congregations. Now, that's compared to 24,000 Catholic and Orthodox congregations. It's an immense group of people. But not only is it immense, but it spans a very incredible spectrum. In the Protestant world, and I'm not going to name them all, we wouldn't have time to do that, but you know, one end of the spectrum, and this is probably not necessarily the end of it, we have the traditional mainline churches, then we've got the evangelical churches, and then maybe over here we've got the independent fundamentalist churches, and then everything in between. So it's an incredible spectrum of individuals and congregations. But not only is it the spectrum of churches, but within the Protestant world, and I think this probably exists in any type of culture, we have subcultures within the Protestant world. You're seeing these subcultures growing in various pockets throughout this country more and more each year. The homeschool movement is one of them. What I call the cultural warrior movement is one of them. A cultural warrior movement can be anything from removing ourselves from culture to live on our own. To we want to conquer culture. So there's even a spectrum within the culture warrior movement. So it's a motley group of many. You'd probably never get this group of Protestants all in one room to agree on anything, except for maybe the fact that they're Protestants, and they may disagree about that as well. But we also have another interesting dynamic of the Protestant world, and that is independence. The Protestant culture is defined by independence. The Protestant culture, I had a friend of mine recently tell me, he thought the Protestant culture delights in the independent or escapist identity. For example, the Southern Baptists alone have over 37,000 autonomous churches in this country. Okay? These are all autonomous. There's no hierarchy within that organization. And so it's very, very independent. And these types of cultures often frown, not all, but oftentimes they frown on transparency and accountability outside of the local church, and sometimes even inside within their own individual congregations. And I probably don't need to tell you all, but the abuse of children and many other forms of abuse thrive when there's minimal accountability and limited transparency. So stay with me here. We've got motley group of many, very independent. And then we add the next part of the equation that is hugely significant. And that is those within the what I would call the Protestant abuse culture often focus on distorted biblical teachings to silence victims and protect institutional reputations. Now, I think you have that in just about every faith community. But one of the things that I've learned and studied, and I'm by far not an expert in Catholicism. I'm a Presbyterian, whatever that's supposed to mean. No, I'm a Presbyterian. I'm a proud Presbyterian. But what's different with regard to the Protestant world, I would say maybe a little bit different than the Catholic, is that in the Protestant world, we tend to focus and put a lot of weight and authority on Scripture, far more on Scripture than on the pastor. Now, that doesn't mean pastors don't influence and don't abuse that influence. That happens all of the time. That's one of the methods that's used to abuse. But there's a lot of emphasis put on biblical teachings and the biblical authority. And so what happens is that those who are within the Protestant abuse culture, those within the Protestant world who want to access children, want to gain the trust of children, want to gain the trust of parents, will oftentimes use biblical teachings and distort them. And they do that ultimately to not only gain access, but to silence victims and protect institutions. Let me just give you a few examples. For example, gossip. If you talk about this abuse, you're sinning, you're gossiping, and therefore you need to remain quiet. I have met parents who were on the mission field, and learned that one of their fellow missionaries had, the allegation was that he had sexually abused one of the children on the mission field. The missionary organization brings everybody together on the field and says, this is what's happening. We're going to take care of it. You are not to speak about it when you leave this room because that's gossip. And you know, I had parents who told me, this is 20 years later, who said, I went back to our home and I never asked my son or my daughter whether this man had ever perpetrated on them. And just 3 years ago, I get a call from my son or my daughter, it was both, and they told me for the very first time that that individual had sexually abused them. They're devastated. They blame themselves. They blame the organization. But they're devastated because a biblical truth about gossip was distorted to keep silent about a horrific act. Here's another one. Man, okay. I thought I was being beamed away, which in a few minutes you all might like that. Here's another one. The reputation of Jesus. We have to keep quiet about this because the reputation, we don't want to hurt the reputation of Jesus. Okay? Now, I can tell when I speak to Christians, churches and faith groups, my first response to that is, do you think Jesus needs you? Really? If you truly believe he's the God of the universe, you're really upset by that? No, he doesn't need that. But here's the more important thing. Most of the time when that's said, there's not a great concern about the reputation of Jesus. The greater concern is about their own reputation and the institution's reputation. See, because in the Christian faith, Jesus actually pursues the broken, the abused, and the institutions that are a mess. You don't hide it. You acknowledge it. You're transparent. I tell people all of the time as Christians, we believe that Jesus was most powerful, God was most powerful when Jesus, his son, was transparent and vulnerable on the cross. Isn't that an incredible model for the Christian church to follow? But we quite often do it backwards. And, you know, the other thing I would just say quickly about that is most people realize that abuse knows no boundaries. So when we talk about reputation, most people are more upset, understandably so, not that the abuse occurred, because, yes, you need to be vigilant in stopping it, but it still will occur at times. But it's the response. Do you acknowledge it or do you deny it? When you deny it, that's what hurts your reputation, and you brought that on yourself. You have nobody else to blame but yourself. I'll just a couple more real quick ones. Salvation. I had kids on the mission field who are now adults who were abused, and they were staying in a boarding school. And they were told when they were abused that if you tell anybody, if you tell your parents who are out in the field, because that's a whole other story. You know, these people go to the middle of Africa, and then when their kids are like 5 or 6, this is changing now, so it's a positive thing, but they send them to a boarding school 1,000 miles away. And they all think they're okay because their fellow missionaries are manning the boarding school. Usually it was the missionaries they couldn't fit anywhere else, so they just put them to watch the kids. That says a lot about what their view of children is. But regardless, you be quiet about it, because if your parents have to leave the field and come get you, there will be Africans who go to hell because of you. Now, we're all like, wow, when I first heard that the first time, like, man, it's, then I think, man, what if I was 7 years old? What if I was 10 years old and heard that? Destroys a soul. Sexuality. Sexual abuse is sex outside of marriage, and it's sin. Sexual abuse is sex outside of marriage, and it is sinful. I've had many people within the Christian church who were victims tell me that's what their perpetrator used to say. And then they would sit in church and hear the pastor talk about sex outside of marriage being sinful. Do you think that silences a victim? Absolutely. One person recently said, this is another distorted truth, it's not spiritual to be in pain or question authority. Now, those are the equations. That's the motley group of people plus independence plus distorted biblical teaching. Let me give you an example. I'm going to try to be real quick here. Let me give you an example of what I think shows what happens as a result of that equation. And I want to talk about real briefly the mission field. I believe the mission field in all too many circumstances is a magnet for child sexual abuse. Today there are over 4,000 known evangelical mission agencies sending out over 250,000 missionaries. In my opinion, the mission field is an area of the Protestant culture where abuse is most prevalent. Here's the dynamic that I've encountered over and over again. Grace oftentimes will be called in to do independent investigations to look into past issues of abuse. And here's the dynamic I see. I call them the three walls of silence. The first wall is what we just talked about a minute ago. Silence between members from talking about abuse. You don't talk about it because it's gossip. Wall number two, silence between the institution and the local authorities. Why aren't we reporting these perpetrators to the local authorities? Now, it can be a little bit complex in certain jurisdictions. I can grant you that. We could have a whole conversation about that. But ultimately, that's usually not why it's not reported. Why it's usually not reported is the agency's fear of being thrown out of the country. We have spent years and years and thousands, perhaps millions of dollars in this country. We don't want to risk getting thrown out. And if we report this abuse, that may happen. So we'll keep silent. All that money wasted, one person told me, if we get thrown out. It's not good Christian stewardship with our money if we get thrown out, really. And then the last silence, wall of silence, is silence between the institution and supporters back home. We don't want to tell supporters back home what's gone on here because we fear that reputation issue again. So what's the consequence to that type of environment? The consequence of that type of environment is it's a very attractive environment for sexual offenders. Think about this. What's the worst case scenario? If I get caught, I might be able to cry and talk about grace and forgiveness, and they'll think that the Holy Spirit's at work, and they'll give me a hug and put me right back to where we're going. That's perhaps. But let's say they don't buy that. What's the next option? Well, I may get sent home. But if I get sent home, it's not going to be with a letter to law enforcement or even to the missionary supporters about why I'm getting sent home. And so what happens? I get sent home. Missionary organizations are in need of people. And what do? I go to the next missionary organization, and off I go back to the mission field. It's a very dangerous culture. It's a very destructive culture. I just finished it. We finished an investigation not long ago, and right before we were to turn over the report, they fired us, which I'm not bitter about that. I'm just a little disappointed. But here's what goes on. Physician on the mission field gets caught abusing a child. What do they do? They send him back home with a letter to all the supporters saying he was sent home for a moral indiscretion. He goes to some counseling. He decides to get out of missions because he's a doctor. He can make more money at home. And you know, for the past 20 years, he ran a family practice up in Michigan. Nobody knew that this man had not only sexually abused one child, numerous children on that mission field, and had actually confessed to at least one, and was practicing medicine, family practice, in the state of Michigan. So it's a very very attractive environment for offenders, and it's a very destructive environment and dangerous environment for children and abuse survivors. Now, I will say in my last point, because I don't want to sound so depressing that you go, wow, this guy's, you know, I'm glad he's first, so we can maybe forget about what he said by the time we're finished. But I'm not sure if you're going to hear much more encouragement from the others. But let me just tell you this. There is some good news, and I call the good news baby steps. 5 years ago, in my opinion, there was virtually very little public discourse within the Protestant institutions or leaders on the issue of child sexual abuse. Everybody was talking about the Catholics. I get so tired of talking to my Christian brothers and sisters in the Protestant world and them talking about how terrible the Catholics are. And then I go, really? I said, I think we're worse. But it's just harder to keep track because we have so many and we're independent. It's a great opportunity to use that equation, help them understand that. But here's some things that have happened even in the last year that I think is cause for some hope. This summer, over 70 evangelical leaders from around the country signed a public statement regarding sexual abuse in the church. Grace helped bring together a motley group, a bunch of independent-minded Protestants, to come together to sign this statement. In my opinion, it's a very powerful statement about this issue. People like Paul Young, who wrote The Shack, and Michael Reagan, who's a survivor of child sexual abuse, signed this statement. It's a very powerful public statement saying, no more. This is wrong, and we need to start to talk about it, and we need to begin shining a big spotlight in this area within the Protestant world. Secondly, like I mentioned earlier, rise of independent investigations to deal with past issues of abuse. Grace has done that with New Tribes Mission, which is a very large mission agency, and abuse that occurred over in their mission field in West Africa. We're currently working on an independent investigation. We were retained by Bob Jones University. Are you anybody familiar with Bob Jones University? Okay. That's like the mothership of fundamentalism. It really is. And they came to us and said, we have concerns that we may not have responded to abuse disclosures well. And we want you to investigate that. And we said what we've usually said with all the others. We say, we'll do that, but it has to be completely independent. That means you control nothing. You cooperate, you have to pay our invoice, but that's it. And when we're done with the report, it's published publicly. And you don't get it a few months ahead of time, or you don't get to choose which parts of the report you want published. It's got to be transparent. We got to be. That's great. Professor Law, I'm saying I've got to be in front of a bunch of journalists. That's embarrassing. We have to be transparent. And sometimes those environments are the most difficult. Two major conferences occurred in the past year that I've been a part of, and I think there are more, but there was one back in, I think it was April. It's the one that the Chicago Tribune wrote about. MK Safety Net was an organization that, very first conference of its type, which brought together missionary kids who had suffered abuse on the mission field and brought them all together from various organizations to begin to process this, to begin to hear speakers on how to address this, to begin to think about how to address this within those institutions, how to bring these issues to surface. Very, very powerful. I just came from another conference last weekend in Greenville, South Carolina, which is in the backyard of Bob Jones University. That is the heart of the Bible Belt. And this conference was called Open Your Eyes. And the purpose of this conference was to open the eyes of the church, the Protestant church, but any church. I don't care. With regard to the issue of child sexual abuse and the prevalence of it and how to respond to it. Over 300 people attended from 5 different states. Very powerful weekend. And 2 quick other things. Homeland Security. You say, what does Homeland Security have to do with this? Well, I'm very encouraged. Homeland Security is now taking a law that exists called the PROTECT Act that authorizes the U.S. government to prosecute U.S. citizens who sexually abuse a child anywhere in the world. And now they're arresting, sadly, it's tragic, but in some sense it's very good. They're arresting missionaries and others within nonprofit organizations overseas, with churches who have been abusing children for years, and they're getting caught at the border and being prosecuted. That's a good sign. It's tragic, but it's good because it's bringing things to the surface. Something is being done. And one of the things I'm very excited about is Grace is beginning to put together what's called the National Grace Center. The National Grace Center is going to be located on the campus of a Christian university. We're speaking currently now to Pepperdine University over in California. And the National Grace Center, I won't go into all the detail, but the National Grace Center will begin training those on the front lines of tomorrow, today. We'll also begin training and preparing seminary curriculum for pastors in seminary today so they're not learning on the job. And I'm getting told this. Okay, that's good. So I'm very excited about that. If you told me 5 years ago we would have interest in a National Grace Center to address this issue publicly within the faith community, I probably would have laughed. So this is very encouraging. So in closing, let me just say this. I'm part of a faith tradition that is founded upon what we call the Gospel of Jesus. The Gospel is about a loving God who sacrificed himself even to the point of death in order to preserve and protect the human soul. Tragically, too many institutions within the Protestant evangelical world have actually sacrificed human souls in order to preserve and protect their positions and their institutions, all the while telling others about Jesus. We've got the gospel backwards. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, most of you know that parable. The man was beaten up on the side of the road, and those who belonged to the church walked by, and they kept walking because they all had very important things to do. And the one that was least expected to help crossed the street, moved towards the hurting, and tended and served that person until they were well. That is my hope and that is my prayer, that one day the church will do the same thing for those who have suffered under child sexual abuse. Thank you.
Candace Conti is a survivor of sexual abuse. She's also, says she's now a student studying veterinary science, so hopefully in a few years she'll be a veterinarian. But when she learned that her abuser had gone on to abuse other victims, she first tried to get her church to do something about it. And when they didn't, she sued the Jehovah's Witnesses organization, the Watchtower, and her abuser. The case went to a jury trial, and she was awarded last year a landmark settlement. This was in Northern California. And she continues to do work to press the church's headquarters to change their policies, which she's going to tell you about. So I'm very happy to have her here. And
I was much more comfortable sitting down. I want to thank you all for being here today and start off by saying that even though I was born and raised a Jehovah's Witness and I learned my public speaking skills at a very young age, most likely knocking on some of your doors Saturdays and Sunday mornings, I am still super nervous for being up here. So I'm going to follow my flashcards and hope I can rely on you that if I miss something, you will have great follow-up questions. I am a survivor of child sexual abuse in the Jehovah's Witness religion. And it is impossible to give you the clearest picture of what it's like to grow up in this religion in only a few minutes. If I was going to give you one word that I feel makes the Jehovah's Witnesses unique, it would be isolation. Their belief promotes a sense of isolation that leaves its members' lives completely and utterly reliant on each other for any social interaction. Growing up, I tried to be the best Jehovah's Witness I could be, putting in many hours to do the work of Jehovah. Between the ages of 9 and 11, I was violently sexually abused by a member of our congregation. He was a ministerial servant, a trusted member of our congregation, a trusted brother. Growing up, I went through all the issues that young people do when their innocence is stolen away. And when I got older, I became curious, and I looked the creep up on the internet. More specifically, the government registry websites and Megan's Law. I really didn't know what I was expecting to find, but I found him. He was charged with molesting a child after me. And as I read his charges, I began to break down. The similar age of the girl and the violent nature of the crimes themselves, I was furious. I had no idea of the background of this case. I just felt that at the time, I had to know if he was still an active member of Jehovah's Witnesses. And if he was, the elders had to know that he was a repeat offender. I contacted a congregation that was in the city I lived in at the time and asked if they could tell me if someone was disfellowshipped or reinstated. Being disfellowshipped, or being a disfellowshipped Jehovah's Witness, means the complete loss of privileges to associate with any other member of the Jehovah's Witness organization, and this includes family. The elders told me that unless he was disfellowshipped or reinstated in that current congregation, they wouldn't be able to answer that question. Thinking that odd, I asked, what if it was sexual abuse? What do you do to prevent sex offenders from hiding themselves and coming in and preying on the children in your congregations? I had no reasonable answer. They had no reasonable answer. I saw a complete lapse in security. No way of tracking these individuals. After leaving, I started coming up with ideas, changes in policy, databases that could be created to protect congregations in other areas from these repeat offenders. I went back to the elders and now told them my story, along with my ideas. They said it was time to make a report to the Watchtower in New York and to talk to the elders of the original congregation. So I did. I talked to the elders that watched me grow up as a child. I told them my story, and I told them my ideas. They sent the report to New York, and the response that we got back was before they were willing to listen to any of my ideas, I needed to prove it happened to me first. Judicially, in the Bible, crimes are solved by a two-witness rule. Two witnesses to the crime need to be willing to testify on your behalf, and you need to be willing to confront the suspect in open court. Well, as we all know, even one witness is very rare in any of these types of crimes. I became curious about how cases were dealt with in our court system. That's when I went to my attorney. I told him my story. I told him my goals. And I told him how my ideas to protect children in the future were perceived by the Jehovah's Witnesses. I then learned my only option was to file a civil lawsuit. It was the only way, the only tool provided to me by our legal system. So I filed suit. Through the power of the court, we obtained documents. In those documents was a report that was made by the elders of the very congregation I grew up in and sent to the Watchtower. This was a report of my sexual abuser molesting his stepdaughter shortly before turning his eyes to me. They kept this a secret. Another document that was obtained through the power of the court was the 1989 policy letter. This letter openly promotes a policy of secrecy for liability issues. Seeing this document gave me more fuel. I needed to publicize this. We needed to make changes to this. I wanted no settlement. Thank you. We went to trial. Sorry. I don't make public speeches that often, if at all.
You're doing really good.
Okay, so the jury, not only religious, but also openly against major money verdicts. These were facts that we found out during jury selection. They saw the evidence. They read through the information. And they sat through testimony. Several times comments were made by the judge saying how amazed he was about how attentive this jury is. This was the jury statement. A guilty verdict and damages awarded of $7 million. That's a high statement. The highest single amount awarded in a child sex abuse case. That same day, the jury made a verdict that the Watchtower and Jehovah's Witnesses' acts were reprehensible, and they were found guilty of malice. In the punitive damages argument the next day, my attorney asked for treble damages to punish in the amount of $21 million. The jury awarded $21,001,000. They later stated, our jury, later stated that this was their way of making a statement to the Jehovah's Witness organization and the Watchtower that these policies have to change. You cannot do this anymore. Shortly after our verdict, a new policy letter was written that does away with the two-witness rule, and to replace it was a two-victim rule to make proof. This was in hope that it would lead to more molesters being disfellowshipped, which will limit the opportunity to prey upon children in their current congregations. While my attorney says this is a step in the right direction, I say it's still not good enough. The policy of secrecy is still in this letter, but our major victory is that it's not so secret anymore. This is my story. It may be unique that it was the first case to go to trial against the Watchtower and the Jehovah's Witnesses, but this is not unique and only limited to this religion. It affects every organization and every institution. Oh, I'm not going to cry through this. For me personally, my strength through this case was hoping that through all of this hurt and through all of this struggle, we could make a difference that could save one child, and that is a struggle worth fighting for. If we could do that, I would win. The only thing I want to leave you with here today is that through your hard work and your determination reporting these cases, you need to know you empower victims to come forward and fellow survivors to come forward. You give them a voice, and through their voice and your hard work, you are policy changers. Through your diligence in getting these bad and inadequate policies in the public eye, you force these organizations and institutions to make changes. So please go out and continue to make a difference. Thank you.
William Bowen was an active Jehovah's Witness for 43 years, and the reason he's here as well is to talk some of the looking ahead. There are a lot more stories to be done about this particular church. He served as an elder and worked at the organization's headquarters in New York City, and in December of 2000, he resigned as an elder after he tried to handle an accusation of child abuse by someone in his congregation and found the church was not responsive. He became an activist and founded the organization Silent Lambs, which serves survivors of abuse, but not just in the Jehovah's Witnesses, in many churches. He's appeared frequently in news stories on the issue and has served as an advisor and an expert witness in lawsuits against the Watchtower organization. Bill?
Thank you for having me here today. As Mrs. Goodstein more or less summarized, I was a second-generation member of the organization. And every part of my being was wrapped up in serving the church. And as she briefly explained, when I discovered a fellow elder was a confessed child molester, I worked for almost a year within the church to try to have him reported to the police. And when I presented further allegations he was molesting yet another child to the legal department, they told me to leave it in God's hands. And that was a moment for me when something broke. I couldn't do it anymore because I realized that if they're going to hurt kids, what are they capable of? And I couldn't be part of an administration that hurt kids anymore. So I went to the media, and I said, somebody needs to know about this. And when I did, I pulled all the letters, this letter that Candace described. I released that letter in addition to other letters that explained their policy on abuse. So I knew they would say I was lying, and they did, but I had proof. And even to members, proof doesn't really make much difference because they have to follow. So began kind of a war, you might say. I had hundreds of victims contacting me at this time, and I in March of 2001, I founded this organization, Silent Lambs, not to promote my agenda, but to give victims a voice, to help them to tell their stories. On the site, we have over 1,000 websites. Before, when victims came forward, they were just like angry ex-members. Hard to do a story on an angry ex-member. But when they had an elder in the church saying, yeah, this happened, and it's true, this is their policy, then it gave them a platform. And so we started doing stories. We started doing documentaries. We did Dateline in May of 2002. And we did Panorama in the BBC in England in June of 2002. And the Sunday program in Australia, Fifth Estate in Canada. To date, we've done 25 documentaries in 15 different countries that have probably been seen by over 1 billion people. And in each and every documentary, victims speak. Because I refuse to do a documentary unless they're able to. And even when I speak today, I always carry a lamb with me because that lamb represents all those that can't speak. How many people I've talked to? I've talked to over 7,000 victims of abuse. And many say, I can't tell anyone else yet. But in time, they will. We have over 1,000 stories on the website, and many that read those stories have been enabled to step forward and tell their stories. Candace's mother came to me 10 years ago, and we looked at things legally. I helped file the first lawsuit in May of 2001. I work with Jeff Anderson and Levin Norris in Texas here. And we literally wrote the first document that would stick that explained the complicated hierarchy of the organization and how they worked. So thus began this pebble being pushed up the hill legally. And so many people before Candace came forward and put their hearts and souls on the line and told their story. And many times it was lost due to the statute of limitations or due to some loophole that the church was able to exploit. And over and over again, but yet that pebble moved a little bit farther. And finally, with her case in the summer of last year, it finally reached the top of the hill. And precedents are set now that other victims can come forward. And that's why I'm here. I think you guys are going to get a lot of stories. But I want you to understand the nature of how these stories came to be and how they came to pass. I work with Jehovah's Witnesses and other high-control groups. And as Boz mentioned earlier, these groups use insularity and secrecy and Jesus to hurt kids, as simple as that. I'm working now with the Tony Alamo Ministries trial that's we're ongoing. And in that case, Tony Alamo, who has ministries in Nashville, Tennessee, and Fort Worth, Arkansas, declared himself a prophet. And part of the prophecy that Jesus gave to him was that when young girls reached the age where they had their periods, that they were able to be married in plural marriages. So Mr. Alamo proceeded to take brides of the age of 16, 14, 12, 11, and finally 9. Before he was finally convicted and sent to prison for 150 years for child molestation. How did he get away with it for so long? Well, he had a religion, and he used religion in order to do that. And as Candace very well pointed out, Jehovah's Witnesses have a policy too. That is that they require two eyewitnesses before a child's allegation of abuse can be believed in the face of the molester's denial. How many molesters do you know molest kids in front of other people? Doesn't happen. So as a result, when I did Dateline, I called it a pedophile paradise, because all the molester has to do is deny the allegation. The elders turn to the child and say, you don't have any witnesses, he remains an innocent man, and if you say anything against him, you'll be charged with slander and you can be disfellowshipped. So the child is silenced. The family is silenced. Thus the name, Silent Lambs. Thousands of silent lambs throughout this organization. And thus the reason why legally they have to be brought to task. And the question is, when we go to court with Alamo Ministries, with the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know what they wave around the courtroom? The First Amendment. The First Amendment defends their religious right to make this happen. In a large part, this goes all the way back to the history of Jehovah's Witnesses. In the earliest part of the 20th century, Jehovah's Witnesses brought 23 separate First Amendment actions before the U.S. Supreme Court between 1938 and 1946, of which they won. These rulings actually define how the First Amendment is used for the benefit of religion. First Amendment states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And it goes on about freedom of speech and other things, but due to the recent controversy concerning religious rights and law, it might be helpful to review the historical background of the United States Constitution in order to correctly understand the proper meaning of the First Amendment regarding religious freedom. It appears the passage of time has contributed to the loss of what our original founding fathers wanted when they established the First Amendment for its very purpose. Remember when the 13 colonies revolted against England, it was due to the fact that the colonists were not being treated as free men. Whereas most people today are aware of the economic and military oppression of the colonists, many, it seems, have forgotten the element of religious oppression that was the experience of Americans. And they came here to get religious freedom. Patrick Henry once saw a man whipped so mercilessly that he later died. Why? The man was a preacher who refused to buy a license to preach. William Penn once was on trial for his life because of disagreeing with the doctrine of the Church of England. Religious freedom for individuals is what was in the mind of early Americans as they drafted the Constitution in its First Amendment, not organizational religious freedom. The religious establishment back then had a very significant difference between then and now. Most countries today, even though they may have established religions, people practice religion freely. Not the tone 200 years ago. 200 years ago, you could be killed if you did not agree with the doctrine and practices of the church. So while the Anglican Church continues as the established church in England, what religion became established in the new United States? None. Why? Because the First Amendment prohibited Congress from making any law respecting an establishment of religion. When it realized that only a state-sanctioned church can be properly called an establishment, and when it noted the United States had no religious establishment according to the proper meaning of the term, then it became clear that the First Amendment would have to be totally unnecessary. How could Congress make any law respecting religious establishment to regulate or interfere when there's no religious establishment anywhere in the United States to be interfered with? We don't have it. The First Amendment knocks it down. When secular courts treat all religious organizations as establishments of religion, free from government regulation, they create serious inconsistencies in law. They allow inalienable rights to be alienated from American citizens. In effect, whereas Congress has not made, nor can it make any law which establishes a religious organization to be the official church of state, the courts have made law which makes all religions official. All religions have stated sanctions to mistreat their own members, much like the medieval churches, due to their members who are not allowed. They can't burn them at the stake or kill them, but on the other hand, they can express church sanctions that destroy families, punish the innocent, and exercise absolute control over their members. When courts allow religious organizations to violate what is normally the law of the land by violating civil liberties and denying natural justice to others. They're parties to these illegal activities. They aid and abet. Okay. So, the context of clergy-penitent privilege when it comes in conflict with state laws regarding child abuse would have no bearing if it obstructed justice. It might be compared to U.S. Bank. If there was a CEO of the company and he allowed his lower managers to molest children, and then if that was found out, he'd be led away in chains. Yet a cardinal can oversee the molestation of children and let it go on, and all he is slightly sanctioned, and he continues to receive his pay. So the point of it is, when religion takes the rights of the individual away using the First Amendment as a basis, it is a compromise of the very reason the First Amendment was written to begin with. The First Amendment was written to protect the rights of the people, not to protect the rights of religion to oppress the people. And the message it must be communicated is that all crimes otherwise required to be reported by any citizen should have the same application when it comes to religious context. Any religion that suppresses the obeying of civil liberties and natural justice should face the same penalties in the courts as any entity that commits similar actions. It is only then the United States Constitution will fulfill its intended purpose, and that is to protect the individual freedom of each and every citizen. So I thank you for listening to me today. And I was going to say in the beginning, when you talk to religion writers, you think, well, they're for religion. And I thought I was going to get crucified when I first tried to do an interview with a religion writer. But I really appreciate, through the years, religion writers have told the truth. You're truth tellers. And by you telling that truth, it makes religion better. I don't want to destroy Jehovah's Witnesses. I want to make them a better religion. And by doing so, we protect kids and we allow people to practice their faith and move forward in a way that helps people. And if we can do that, then that's a noble cause. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take some questions, but before we do, we've had an interesting development that I would call a touch of almost, synchronicity or something. We are visiting on Saturday nearby Hindu temple, and we've learned that, in fact, that temple has had its own abuse scandal, and we've been contacted by someone who has written a book about this. Here's the book cover. And she is here, Karen Johnson. And so Karen has volunteered to talk a little bit briefly about what happened there. So in some ways to prepare us for this visit, so we go in with our eyes open. The place is called, I might say it wrong, Radha Madhav Dham? Is that, yeah? Okay. So that's where we're going on Saturday. So she's going to tell us a little bit about the story there, okay? Before we have questions. Okay,
come on. Hi. I feel very lucky to have found out about this just by chance yesterday afternoon. A friend of mine, I don't even know how she found it, but she said, look, she actually posted it on my Facebook page where I report on what I call the cult. And so I immediately looked for names and phone numbers and started contacting members of the organization. And we made a connection this morning, and they invited me. So it was completely serendipitous. And I would have to say, I would have to say my involvement and ability to tell the story of what happened in this organization has involved a lot of serendipity. From how I even found out what was really going on behind the scenes after living in where you'll be going on Saturday is an ashram, a Hindu ashram with a temple. People live there, devotees, as I was one for 15 years. I moved to Austin to live there in 1993 and lived there as a devotee, struggling religiously to do my duty and achieve my spiritual goals. And in May of 2007, the head guru, my book actually is called Sex, Lies, and Two Hindu Gurus. It's a bit complicated to have two, but one of them was the one who founded the temple here, and one who is the guru who's the head of the whole organization. And he was on a world tour, including Austin, and he went to Trinidad and was arrested for raping a young girl there. I believe she was 21. When they told us in the ashram a week later, they brought us all together, told us, they said, do not go on the internet to learn anything else beyond what we told you. And they didn't use the word rape. They used the word assault. He was falsely accused of assault. That was the moment I broke, my brainwashing broke. I went straight back to my computer, typed in his name and the word Trinidad, and all these articles popped up. And not only articles, but comments. I read hundreds of comments in a state of shock for 30 days, learning about how much this man in particular has a long, long history of abuse. It trickles down to the others. One of the others was my main guru who founded this organization. He was arrested in 2008 on 20 counts of indecency with a child. It was 10 counts each for two girls. Those two and one other girl who all were raised in that Barsanadom. Well, it used to be called Barsanadom. They were all in the trial. He was convicted on all 20 counts. He escaped the day before sentencing to Mexico. They couldn't find him. We believe there were payoffs. The U.S. Marshals were looking for him. And then in November of that same year, 2008, he escaped to India. Now, many of the devotees who live in this ashram helped him escape. There is a document created by the U.S. Marshals that outlines a portion, just a portion, of some of the people that helped him get into Mexico, stay hidden in Mexico, and then get to India in a disguise and a fake passport. And he's now under the protection, of course, of the organization, which is extremely wealthy. In 2011, they opened a brand new temple that it easily cost about $1 billion. They will tell you they're a charitable organization and they're building hospitals. And what they've got are little tiny clinics that are only staffed occasionally with volunteers. And meanwhile, these huge, big, elaborate temples, several of them. And as far as like any kind of lawsuit, there won't be any, because what U.S. lawyers found after researching it is all the money the organization has, which is a lot, it's tied up in a complicated network of India-based trusts. So there will never be a civil suit. However, one child who was raped, a U.S. citizen who was raped at 13 when her family took her over to India, which happens a lot. People from the U.S. go to India to spend time with the guru, usually a few weeks or a month or so. At 13, she was raped. I happen to know the whole story because she finally revealed it to her mother at the age of 18. After my guru was arrested, she finally was able to tell her mother. And the way it happened was another adult preacher, who they all wear orange, the preachers in that religion, took her to his room, put her in the room with him alone, locked the door. The girl was raped by him. And when she came out, she was crying, of course. She was just in shock. And this preacher told her, consider it your wedding night with Krishna. Krishna is one of the forms of God in Hinduism. That story, I could tell you, I don't know the victims, but I know this has gone on hundreds, if not thousands of times since this man has been a guru, which is 60 years. I have information. If any of you want more, I've got links to documents. I have a whole library. So if you have any questions before you go out there that you want to ask me, please do. I've got cards here, too, if you want my contact information.
Okay, thanks. Who knew, right? It's really great that you were able to be here, and I hope you will stick around. Yeah. Okay, so questions? Jeff, you want to go to the microphone? So, I mean, can everybody hear? Yeah, I think you should. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Jeffrey Weiss. how do I identify myself these days? I guess freelance religion writer is as good as any. Candace, first of all, what year did you go to the elders to attempt them to get them to change the policy? Because that affects my question.
It was in 2005.
2005. All right. So this, I guess, would be probably for all three of you, the enormous focus on the Catholic Church scandal. Surely Protestant leaders, Jehovah's Witness leaders, saw what was happening there and were at least aware, whether or not they had a moral position, that we could discuss, that how bad it went for the Catholic Church institutionally. Do you have any sense that they were aware of that? I mean, I would assume that they were aware of that, and that that colored their reactions, made them either more or less willing to move in any direction. It just seemed to me that the context in which clergy abuse had become so openly written about, I wonder whether that affected any of the other polities, and in particular, I guess the Jehovah's Witnesses that you're familiar with, Mr. Bowen from the inside, and Candace going to it. And by the way, let me start by saying, Candace, thank you for coming to talk to us. That was obviously not easy, and we appreciate it. So that's my question.
I was told to go first. I was suggested. Sorry. I don't think it makes a difference. This is my own experiences. I don't think there's been research on it. There's an incredible amount of arrogance out there. And what I've experienced is that's a Catholic Church problem. And Protestants can be very arrogant as it relates to Catholics and will point the fingers at the Catholics and say, well, it's because their priests don't marry and because all these different things, and all the while never examining themselves. Sadly, you would think, wait a minute, let's take a look at ourselves. That has not happened.
I think that as far as the Jehovah's Witnesses are concerned, it was pointing the finger. It was, we're not the Catholic religion. We're better than that. And I think if anything, the response to it would have been kind of tightening the ropes a little bit with their kind of internal structure to work on that secrecy policy and really kind of pushing that isolationism, because if you're not looking on the outside of what society sees as a morally wrong thing, if you're not looking at that, it's easier to really just say, okay, maybe this isn't that bad of a situation. So,
and to explain it kind of from an inside perspective, in 1991, Jehovah's Witnesses wrote an article in Awake magazine about repressed memory. They received hundreds of letters that caused them to instigate an internal investigation into the extent of abuse. A 50-page report was submitted to the governing body, which is like their prophets. They have eight guys that completely control the entire religion. In that report, they made three recommendations to help the problem, to make better policy. Number one, all allegations be immediately reported to the police for proper investigation. Number two, no molester should be allowed to go door-to-door on the unsuspecting public. And number three, no molester would ever have a position of authority within the church. The governing body threw that report in the trash. And to this day, not one of those policies has been enacted fully by the organization. So they are haughty. They don't care. They would prefer to have control and pay off victims rather than change their policy. And until they pay enough, I don't think they're going to change.
Actually, interestingly enough, just to add to that, is in their policy letter, it is not the first step to go to the police. The first step is to contact the Watchtower's legal department. That is the first step in when becoming aware of a potential child abuse case.
I should know, because I reported the fellow elder who was an abuser. And when I did, I was told by the legal department to Kentucky at that time was a non-reporting state, so I was to not report the matter. So that was my instruction. I got it on tape. It's on Dateline. You can listen to it. And they denied that they told me that, but I recorded it. So.
Okay. Good question.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Faulkner Newhall from Oakland, California, freelancer. Question primarily for Mr. Javidian.
Mr. T, if you want.
Mr. T. can you give give us some kind of figures as to the number of cases of child sexual abuse you've seen in Protestant denominations? Is there some way we can kind of
substantiate this? Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the only figures we're able to collect so far are from insurance underwriters. And I just talked about this last weekend, and I think I don't have it in front of me. I think there was, you know, I want to say 24-25% of abuse cases within the Protestant Church are repeat cases. I think that was one of the figures that they gave. And if you I give you my contact information. I can give you that specific figure. I don't like to just throw figures out. But here's the problem. It's an insurance underwriter, which means that that only involves churches who have reported who have insurance to cover this, and churches who have reported that. So there are a lot of churches that don't have insurance that cover this type of act, and there are many, many, obviously, people who don't report it to begin with. So those numbers are whatever figure I end up giving you, are very low because of the statistic. And it's just hard because there's so many to be able to collect those statistics under one roof, more like the Catholic Church, which is much more structured. It's a good question.
Hi, I'm Tim Barger. I'm with the Toledo Blade. And I want to thank you all for coming and helping us with this difficult issue. And Ms. Conti especially, I admire your strength and your compassion in continuing to tell the story and to share that with others. And I can tell just from this that you're going to be good with animals as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
The question that I want to ask is, when we get to the organizational level, we're dealing with churches that very much push the policy of redemption, that even people under their roofs who have done things very bad have been spiritually cleansed, they claim. So do you have any suggestions on how to deal with organizations that do have at least one incident, if not many, in their background and still dealing with them today in the after situation?
We get that a lot. You know, that issue is one of those other distorted biblical teachings. Forgiveness, redemption, what does that mean? And that we could go on forever on this, but this particular issue. I would say that, you know, one of the things that we talk about is that if you're for example, somebody will say, you need to report Matthew 18. Matthew 18 says if somebody's done a personal wrong against you, you're supposed to go to them first and then go take a brother. And so what happens is people say, well, this is what's happened to my child. Pastor says, well, we need to go talk to the offender. We got to follow Matthew 18. Well, think about it. If you're driving to work in the morning and you see a member of your church holding up the 7-Eleven, now what are you going to do? You're going to go, I got to stop in there and say, excuse me, what you're doing is wrong, and then if you ignore me, I'm going to go get one of our church members to come back to you. In the meantime, the clerk's dead, and who else is hurt in the meantime? No, you report it to law enforcement. I really believe this, that law enforcement and the civil authorities are God-ordained. That's how God protects people. And so the misuse of those terms can be very devastating, and it's the same thing, forgiveness. One of the things we talk about with churches is they say, well, he says he's sorry. Well, here's some questions to ask him. Ask him if he's told his wife everything. Ask him if he is going to call his child or the victim's therapist and fill them in on everything that happened to assist in the therapy. Ask him if he has gone to report himself to the police and to deal with the consequences, earthly consequences to his earthly acts. And so often, the responses you get from some of those questions exposes the heart of whether there's really authentic repentance or not. And even if there is authentic repentance, you absolutely still put safeguards in within the church because there's still earthly consequences to these horrific acts.
And also, I'd like to comment. I work with a law firm, Zalkin, out of San Diego, and we just filed a case in New Mexico in which a mother was molested by a man, and he repented. The elders met with him and offered him its spiritual encouragement. And so the elders then met with the mother and told her that for her to show that she accepted his repentance, she had to let him babysit her child. He subsequently molested her child as well. Yet she was following spiritual directives given to her by the elders. And you can see why we have a lawsuit. But the point of it is, repentance can be exploited if it's in the wrong hands. There's nothing wrong with repentance. It's a great acceptance of righting the wrong. But how was he repentant, you know, other than he talked to some of his buddies and talked him into letting him stay in? So it shows that, you know, people have a hard time sometimes determining that repentance, and especially when it comes to abuse. I would never accept the repentance of a child molester to be around my children. So repentance is good. I'm glad he's repentant, but you're not going to be around my kids because I'll never trust you.
And I think that's important, too. I mean, we had kind of a similar crazy situation or story from my case, too. I'm not going to get into that. But I think that these religious organizations hide behind that repentance as a way of being able to keep it secret. You know, if the individual is repentant, let's not embarrass them. Let's not put them on the spot in front of the kingdom hall or in front of the congregation. So they don't tell the congregation that there's a potential risk. So their children are still running around like completely unaware. You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses say that you know, we give the tools to the parents to protect their children. Well, if you give them the tools, then tell them who to beware of. Tell them who to watch out for. And that's what they hide behind. They hide behind, well, this individual was repentant, so we're not gonna increase the damage to that person.
I'm Kay Campbell from the Alabama Media Group and the Huntsville Times. Mr. Chibidjan, and I've got a Jehovah's Witness question, so I'll just give them both and you can think about it. I'm really curious about what you said about Homeland Security now being given somehow extraterritorial jurisdiction. Is this only against U.S. citizens abroad, children? You said something about they now can catch these people at the border when they've abused abroad. Does that include sexual tourism to Thailand, or does it just include against American citizens, and how are they going to do that? And also, while it's good to catch bad people, that's an odd legal precedent for the U.S. government to now go after citizens who do bad stuff abroad. And on the Jehovah's Witness side, anytime I write about Jehovah's Witnesses, which is just about every summer because they have this big convention, you know, so I'm doing something, I is guaranteed I'm going to get at least one note from somebody saying, but they're all child molesters, which of course they're not all. But many times these people aren't in my area, or if they are in my area, they don't want to go public. It takes a huge amount of courage to do that. Do you have any suggestions to those of us who would like to tell the truth? How do we report these stories? How do we even work on them besides remembering you're out there in case you've had a case in our area?
You want to work backwards first?
Why don't you go in order of, the questions were asked. Homeland Security, I had that question,
yeah,
too.
That's a good question.
I
want
to hear more about that.
That's something that I wish I would see more writing about, because I have not seen a lot of it. And when I speak, a lot of people are surprised that this law exists. It's called the Protect Act. The Protect Act is a federal law that authorizes the federal government to prosecute any American citizen who sexually abuses a child anywhere, whether it's in the United States or overseas. The motivation, primary motivation behind the Protect Act was the sexual exploitation of children overseas. So Americans who would go to the Philippines and engage in sexual, they have these weekends or weeks they go and they sexually abuse children in particular locations. Those individuals can actually be prosecuted in the United States federal courts for that offense. Now, it becomes an evidentiary problem because you've got to bring these children over to the U.S. to testify, which is very challenging. But the other thing that is going on is the under the Protect Act also authorizes the federal government to prosecute American citizens who sexually abuse U.S. citizens, children, overseas. Those are easier from an evidentiary standpoint because those children usually come back to the States to live. And that's what we're seeing more and more, missionary kids who were abused maybe 6-7 years ago reporting it to Homeland Security. And those individuals, in fact, one individual from who was named in one of our reports that we did, those independent investigations, is being prosecuted now for something he did a number of years ago. But the beauty of it, at least from a former prosecutor standpoint, is it doesn't – the jurisdiction – and, you know, we can have a whole debate about this issue, but the jurisdiction doesn't end at the border of the United States. So if this person sexually abuses a child anywhere, United States government – if he or she is a citizen, United States government has jurisdiction to prosecute that person in U.S. federal court.
Does it apply for, like, murder? Crimes?
Yeah, no. The PROTECT Act is specifically limited to child exploitation, child sexual abuse cases. Now, there may be other federal laws with regard to that. I don't know.
What year that act went into effect?
It's in the 90s, but it was amended. This is not a law class, but it was amended about 6 or 7 years ago to allow them to prosecute to this extent.
Your question is very apropos because I've spoken to over 7,000 victims of abuse. They contact me by the telephone or by email. I say that approximately 1 out of 5 actually tells their story. They may tell it to me in private, but they are not ready yet to come forward. When someone is raised in a kind of a doomsday religion, they're very fearful of everything on the outside. They're very distrustful of anyone and anything. And, of course, molestation is a very personal thing where you expose the most vulnerable time in your life. And what I have found is that, you know, if you need help with a story, if you could refer them to Silent Lambs, have them look at the website and read the stories, a lot of times when they start seeing all these same thing being said by other victims, it emboldens them. It helps give them courage. And they're welcome to call the hotline. We speak to abuse survivors every week, and some are at various places, but when they, you know, I actually have a list of abuse survivors that are willing to come forward to the media and tell their story. And I say, would you like me to put you on the list? And if a story comes up in your area, I'll be glad to put it forward. And so the idea is to not to try to coerce people into telling their story. But when they are ready, they need to. Because when they can tell that story, it creates a threshold moment, in my opinion, where they can move forward and put it behind them. So we want to encourage them to do that, but not pressure them to do that. And if we can do that, and sometimes talking to a former elder, you know, they just have this trust there. They know that you have been on that side of the chair and you know how it works. And, you know, a lot of times I actually can clarify things for people, but sometimes they don't understand what was really going on. And I was talking to a girl just yesterday and I explained, this was what was really going on in your meeting. And it laid to rest something that had bothered her for 10 years just because she was able to understand this. That's what they were doing, you know. And so the idea is to try to bring people peace. And I always believe that peace is having the courage to speak out. And that is moving forward. A abuse survivor told to me like this. They said, if you go around the problem, it just gets bigger. When you face it down the middle, only then can it start to grow smaller. And I thought, no truer words have been spoken. And that describes abuse.
Michelle Borstein from the Washington Post. I wanted to ask more about the legal landscape when I think it was you who mentioned about the First Amendment. I mean, I don't know enough about how often that's cited and how successfully it's used to keep people from coming. I mean, I know obviously about statutes of limitations, but is there a serious issue with the First Amendment being used? And can you be specific? Like, is that state to state? Are there cases right now? Like, can you give us some idea of how big an obstacle that is?
In every case we've had on abuse, they wave the First Amendment around the courtroom like a flag. And anything that brings up religion, they say that's a conflict, that's encroaching upon their freedom of religion. I did, of course, a case in New Hampshire where a man that was convicted for 56 years of molesting his stepdaughter, when his birth daughter came forward and wanted to press charges as well, the court, due to the First Amendment, defended his religious right to privacy. And thus, the documents that the elders had taken in New Hampshire were not allowed to be brought forward to convict him for another 56 years to allow his second daughter to come forward and testify against him. So here, the religious right, this is what I've been trying to explain. Here, the rights of the victim were taken away because the religion, through the First Amendment, can take those rights away and say, we are a person too, and you can't encroach on our rights. So the victim is left to suffer, and the molester sat there with the Watchtower attorneys on his side of the courtroom defending his right as a part of religion.
What's an example that they can't talk about sort of church doctrine, or what are the type of documents that are successfully stuck?
In this instance, the man had confessed to molesting his daughter. Oh. And it was a matter of record that their elders had written down, and they were declaring ecclesial privilege and religious right, his religious right to privacy. So they used the First Amendment to defend that right, and as a result, that material never went forward.
You can also use my case as an example. I mean, and I think any other religious case as an example, because it's true. That's the first thing they wave around is that First Amendment right. For my case, one of the things that I was personally fighting for, and my attorney was fighting for, was the fact that they had known that he was convicted of a misdemeanor when he abused his stepdaughter. And they had known that he was a child molester, and they chose to keep that secret. And so they fought and hid behind the First Amendment right because it's their religious beliefs and how they conduct their religious beliefs to have kept that a secret from the congregation.
If a high school principal knew about a teacher that was molesting children and said, I'm just going to keep this quiet for 10 years, and that teacher molested other children, what do you think would happen to that school? They'd be rolled out on a rail. But if it's a religious institution, no harm, no foul. We got the First Amendment.
Okay, we have just about 8 minutes left, so I can fit both questions in. Keep our answers.
Hi, I'm Janet Heimlich, and I'm a freelance journalist and blogger. I wrote a book on religious child maltreatment called Breaking Their Will, and I have a Facebook group of hundreds of survivors of, it's called Child Friendly Faith. We hear a lot about cases of child sexual abuse, but also cases of other forms of maltreatment. Just taking Jehovah's Witnesses alone, I mean, you have cases of medical neglect where they're not giving kids blood transfusions. We have a lot of problems in Jehovah's Witnesses of physical abuse due to legalistic beliefs about corporal punishment and so forth, as well as emotional terrorizing. I just wondered, it's so important we're talking about sexual abuse, of course, but I just wonder, too, if you could speak to other forms of maltreatment, and is there a reason why we're, you know, maybe more able to talk legally about sexual abuse? Are we brushing some other forms of maltreatment under the rug?
Interesting question. Good question, and maybe trying to keep it tight, but it's a very, very good question.
I agree with you. I think that where I come out of, I think we don't talk nearly enough about physical abuse, and we don't even like to talk about defining it. So you know, the whole issue of corporal punishment, spanking. You even broach that topic, regardless of what your position is. You even broach that topic to even discuss and dialogue about it. And at least in certain evangelical circles, you're like anti-biblical because they take this one verse in Scripture and they parade around it. I sometimes have conversations with people in the world I come from, and it's like they're almost proud of this verse. It's like their life verse. You know, spare the rod, spoil the child, and so if you dare talk about, well, what about so many other verses in Scripture where Christ talks about loving children and what happens to those who hurt children? They don't like to talk about it. So I agree with you. I think it's room for I think sexual abuse, I'm not holding this tight. I think sexual abuse has so many damaging, unique dynamics, especially within the faith context. But you're absolutely right. It's not limited to that, because sexual abuse is a form of physical abuse and a form of abuse in general, and all of those things that you mentioned fall into that category as well.
And just quickly, we have a section on the site called Battered Lambs, and I put that up because so many women were experiencing battery within the religion, and to give them a chance to tell their stories as well. When Jehovah's Witness women go to elders and they've had the living you-know-what beat out of them, they tell them to pray more and be a better wife. They cite articles. Their latest article they cited on battery gave three examples of women that took beatings for 20 years, and their husbands miraculously became Christian
and that's how they turn them around, by taking the beatings. That is the wrong message to any abuse survivor. So that's, it has to change.
And real quick, too, I think that it's difficult because from a legal standpoint, you can fight them and their policies about child abuse. But you have, in America, the freedom of choice. You can believe in whatever you want to believe in. So you have the free will to put yourself in a religion that might oppress you. And you can't fight that. You can't fight that in a legal sense. So it's kind of, it's difficult to address those issues in a legal way.
Okay, Ansley.
My name is Ansley Roan, and I have a question sort of for the two of you in talking about, I was struck by the difference in the way you set up sort of the equation that leads to abuse, and you used the phrase high control organizations, and you talked about these very independent Protestant organizations. So it was just sort of striking to me that they're the opposite, and yet in both types of organizations you see this. And I just wondered if you could just talk about that a little bit. What's the takeaway, the high control, the independent? It's happening in both places. I just wanted to see what you thought.
Well, I would tell you that though the Protestant world is very independent, within those independent bodies, and that we don't have time to go into this, authoritative leadership is probably one of the consistent common threads that we see in abusive environments. So in that sense, I actually think it's very similar. It's just that it's independent. Nobody knows what's going on because it's this church over here that people don't know who goes there and what's going on, whereas in other types of denominations or faiths, it's a little bit more structured, and so at least there's the argument that those higher up the chain knew or should have known what was going on.
And by comparative, when you have independent churches, they're harder to sue because you say, well, we're just one out of, or we're a rogue that happened to have a bad preacher that did this. But with organizations that are high control, all the authority comes from the top. Every elder in Jehovah's Witness has to call home office. They have any allegation of abuse. Home office bears responsibility. So what does that mean? It's a great organization to sue because the buck stops at the home office. We're in the process right now of subpoenaing a member of the governing body, this eight that are untouchable. They live in this ivory tower. It's the equivalent of bringing the Pope in for a deposition. And we want to bring this guy in and have him explain this policy and why they haven't done anything about it and how they've met on this. And this is truly touching the eye of them. And they're going to fight it tooth and toenail. But this is what I fought for 13 years. This is what I wanted to get a gun and let the public see what these guys are doing.
All right. Well, not a light panel. I know it's been tough and heavy, but hope. Yeah, right. But I think really worthwhile. I mean, a lot of work for us to do, I think. And that's the point, right? That's why we're here. So I want to thank these panelists who really poured their heart out, and also thank Karen for her impromptu presentation, which I think was really important, of immediate importance to us here. I also have a few announcements. The RNA board meets at the registration desk at 7 o'clock. Okay, so you guys have some kind of meeting. But the rest of us, I guess, go and have fun. And dinner tonight. I'm supposed to remind you that Ray Liotta will be there, the actor. So a little bit of a celebrity. He'll be at the board meeting. Oh, okay. All right, he'll be at the board meeting. But if you go to the dinner, I'm supposed to tell you that 8:30 is when the drink tickets get handed out. So maybe Ray Liotta won't be there, but the drink tickets will be there. Anyway, thank you all for coming after such a long day. I hope this was worthwhile.